Where was the indignation? Black residents denied housing, corruption at City Hall, and the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, my conversation with Kelly Coors, author of Indignation, A History of Politics and Race in Evansville, 1870 to 1950. There's a riot and deaths after a mob tries to lynch a murder suspect. A high-profile trial involving the son of a prominent businessman. Did he escape justice? And gunplay on a city street involving rival politicians. We'll also learn about the success of a boycott of white-owned businesses, the visit of national civil rights leaders at the turn of the century, two stops in Evansville by Frederick Douglass, and the legacy of Baptist Town, the party bosses there, and the cries for reform. 2 Main Street is next, presented by the Berger Wren Group with Baird Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. Well, let's start with the definition of the word indignation. Indignation is the feeling you get when you know something is unfair, unjust, shameful, or just morally wrong. Indignation is also described as righteous anger. One might ask today, where is the indignation about this or that from politicians, community leaders, and the clergy? One can either endure indignation or try to right a wrong. And there are striking examples of both action and inaction in a new book by Kelly Matthew Coors, the title, Indignation, A History of Politics and Race in Evansville, 1870 to 1950. There's corruption at City Hall, good cops, bad cops, and the rise and fall of the Ku Klux Klan. And through the decades, black voters become pawns in this game of thrones between Democrats and Republicans. Indignation is Kelly Coors' second book. His first, out in Evansville, is A History of Gay Life in the City. So, Kelly, welcome back to 2 Main Street. Really enjoyed the book. And tell me about choosing the word indignation in the title.
Well, the title came from the 1907 incident where two black school teachers that taught at the segregated high school tried to buy a home on Linwood Avenue. And it sent shockwaves through the all-white, because it was an all-white district there, Linwood. And in the newspaper accounts of the incident, the neighbors all held what they called indignation rallies. They were indignant that this black couple would attempt to buy a home in their neighborhood. And the whole thing ended when unnamed neighbors sent notes to the Davises, the couple that were trying to buy the home, that if they moved into the house, it would be burned. And so they canceled the sale. But that word stuck with me, that this indignation, they considered these people to be unworthy and undeserving of this home that they wanted to purchase. And that's it just stuck with me. And I thought that would be that needs to be the title of this book. And luckily the publisher agreed with me when I explained it to them, because they usually tell you what you're going to title a book. So,
well, it's kind of a theme through the book too.
Right. Indignant. People were indignant.
They are. These events that happened are incredible. Yeah. Now throughout the book, there are heated races for mayor. You talk about those a lot. Votes from the predominantly black 7th Ward Baptist Town could sway the outcome, and there's a history of vote buying. Now, tell me about Baptist Town, where the black community lived.
Well, and, you know, we did a study in, you know, DMD. I've been retired for a couple years, but before I left, we updated a study we did on the African-American population, minority population.
Department of Metropolitan Development.
Right, for the city, which taught the second report we got showed that about 60% of the black population still lives within 10 census tracts around downtown, basically where people lived during forced segregation. Black household income is far below white median household income. And so the Baptist Town area, one of the last things that I did was we got the application approved by the National Register to include Baptist Town as a National Register Historic District because of its history. And we were lucky that, you know, urban renewal in most cities just mowed down the old historic black neighborhoods. But Evansville, urban renewal in the 50s, they left it standing because there were so few places black people could move because of the new subdivisions on the east side and the north side weren't open to black families. They were restricted. So they left we were able to find 76 resources buildings in the neighborhood there that were at least 50 years old or older. So we were very, but Baptist Town, it basically encompasses the old Canal Street, Walnut, Lincoln, around where the old Lincoln Gardens and Erie Homes, you see where the African American Museum is, Lincoln School, that area right there colloquially was known as, it was a pejorative in the old days, the nickname because of the Baptist churches that existed there. White Evansville called it Baptist Town. But that name has been reclaimed. There's a new plaque that was put up once the National Register District was named. So, but that's where most African American people lived during this period that I write about.
Now, in 1870, not a very large black population, but it grew, didn't it?
Exponentially after the Civil War, the great diaspora out of the South, the black population here went from 90 in 1860. To about 6,000 in 1900, which was just a geometric explosion of population. And you know, Evansville was a Union city, but its sentiments about race were very much Southern. Segregation, separation, separate but equal when that became, you know, the law of the land. But I started the book basically in 1870 because that's the first election that the 15th Amendment giving African Americans the right to vote took effect. And instantly, there was a repulsion among white Evansville, because it was only men that voted over the age of 21. And so it added maybe 200 new voters to the rolls. But the Republican Party embraced it. Because
the Party of Lincoln.
Party of Lincoln. And the Republicans were able to capitalize on that. And they added, you know, the most black people voted Republican in those days. So the Republicans pretty much embraced this new voting group, while the Democrats generally rejected it. Over the years, they started fighting over it. But at that early days, that's why I started in 1870. That was the first election.
And we had some incredible speakers coming to Evansville around the turn of the century, and before the turn of the century. Frederick Douglass was here.
Twice.
And Booker T. Washington?
Yes, he was. He was here. He was here. The 1909, you know, the Indiana required separate school systems for black and white. And Evansville, by 1900, had four black elementary schools and one black high school. The black high school had a rather small population of students. But in 1909, the graduating class brought in W.E.B. Du Bois as their commencement speaker. And in that class was two gentlemen, Rudolph O'Hara, who became a major player in Republican politics, and George Edmonds, who became a founder of the Kappas, the Kappa Alpha Psi fraternity. In Indiana. And so it was a famous class, a famous speaker. But yeah, Frederick Douglass came here twice.
Mm-hmm. Now, another speaker came to town. I thought this was very interesting. Elias Polk. He was actually enslaved by President Polk, described as a faithful slave, and he campaigned as a conservative Democrat.
He did. It was the 1876 election between Hayes and Tilden, which, of course, you know, ended Reconstruction in the South. And the Republicans had Frederick Douglass crisscrossing the country campaigning for Hayes because Hayes had promised to continue Reconstruction. Tilden was going to end it. And the Democrats had this former slave of President James Knox Polk, Elias Polk, who was 76 years old and very poor health, but he was a very powerful speaker. And they brought him to town the day after Frederick Douglass appeared on the riverfront. But Polk's address was critical of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, and his appearance, which drew a huge audience. But there were some black Republican men there, Robert Nichols, the leader of the black Republicans at the time. Polk pointed out at the audience, and he said, you know, tell me what these amendments have done for a black man in America. And Robert Nicholas stood up and he said, well, they got you in the St. George tonight, which was reported around the Midwest. It was such a great line because the St. George was the hotel that was stood where the McCurdy building stands. Now, it was a nationally famous hotel, which excluded blacks. But they gave Elias Polk a room in order for him to be there to campaign for Tilden.
We're talking to Kelly Coors, author of Indignation, a history of politics in the black community in Evansville. Okay, in 1903, the city in turmoil, very popular Evansville police officer Lewis Massey is shot and killed. Tell me about that incident where he was shot and killed.
Well, it was there was a Fred Ossenberg who became, you know, but this really the book is a story about bosses, political bosses in those days, and Ossenberg became a political boss. But he owned a grocery store and a saloon near 10th and Mulberry Streets. And this gentleman, he had several aliases, Tinsley, Lee Brown. The newspapers at the time referred to him as Lee Brown, but I guess he'd been drinking, refused to pay his bar tab. The bartender threw him out. He said he'd be back with his pistol. And they flagged down Massey, who was on a walking beat, and told him, hey, this guy's coming back with his gun.
And usually you said there are two cops on the beat.
There usually were. This was the 4th of July. And Mayor Covert, there was a shortage of officers at the time. And so he put them on a single officer beat that weekend because 4th of July was on the weekend, which was a huge mistake. But anyway, so Brown came back with his pistol. And when Massey told him to stop, told him to turn around, he pulled his gun and shot the policeman. And then the policeman, of course, staggered. He fired back and hit Brown. And the two of them fired the guns across the street at each other. But Massey fell to the pavement. He was mortally wounded. Mm-hmm. And Brown, they caught him just up the street. You couldn't miss him because he was bleeding too. And put him in jail. But Massey died. He passed away. And when word got out that he was dead, he was the first police officer killed in the line of duty. He was the first one to, but word got out, and there were the night after this tragic death, there were several thousand people in 4th Street in between the courthouse and the jail where they still stand. Mm-hmm. And they wanted this man, they wanted to bring him out of the jail. But Mayor Charles Covert, who was lambasted because of all of the violence that happened here, he and Hukey, the sheriff, they got this man out of the jail, took him out under the street. There's a tunnel under there. Took him out of the courthouse, and they put him on a train for Vincennes. They did not want this to turn into a lynching that you saw in Mississippi or Alabama, and so they got him out of town. But the crowd didn't believe it. They tore down a telephone pole, bashed their way into the jail, and it was just night after night of violence. So finally, the militia came. The state militia, Governor Winfield sent the militia here, and which actually resulted in more deaths.
Right, General McKee.
Yes, General McKee. He was the leader, and he really was disappointed in Mayor Covert. There were a lot of people who thought he showed poor judgment in his handling of this of this incident.
And there was gunfire, and a 15-year-old girl was caught in the crossfire.
Yes, she was. Hazel Allman. I found a picture of her, as a matter of fact, for the book. She was killed. There was a young fella killed who was 15 years old who wanted to be a police officer. Mm. He was up there with the militia talking to the men, and he was killed. It was just an awful situation, mm-hmm. and it gave Evansville a terrible reputation for years mm-hmm. after this. It was a terrible stain. The black population here, which had hovered around 12-13% in the 1900 census, by 1910 had dropped to 6-7%.
Yeah.
Many families just left. They were afraid to be here.
Right. Whatever happened to Lee Brown?
Well, he died. They had transferred him from Vincennes to Jeffersonville, and he died from his wounds. And he was buried, I believe, on the prison grounds there.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of colorful characters in the book, Indignation, A History of Politics and Race in Evansville. Civil engineer Ernest Timmy, and John Jones, the shooter. This is a call for indignation, wasn't it?
Well, Timmy was young. He was about 25, 26 years old.
He was a civil engineer.
Yeah. He'd just come back to town a couple years. It was 1912. His dad was an engineer and had plotted out most of Lincolnshire, the new subdivisions that were growing up on the east side. And Timmy had come back to work with his dad. He'd been out in Arizona, but he'd come back to town, and he'd been at the cigar maker's Christmas ball with his friend Fred Schlamm. And they were walking down Main Street. Timmy had stopped at a hardware store and bought his mother a cake knife for Christmas. It was Christmas Eve. And, in the midst of history, there were so many conflicts about what happened, but there was a black couple with a disabled girl walking down Main Street, and somehow the two men collided with each other. And whatever was the exchange between the two of them, Timmy was quoted as saying, because he'd ran for surveyor, county surveyor, and lost. He was a Republican, and he'd lost the election, and he blamed the black vote because they went for Wilson in the 1912 election. And he blamed them, and some said that he took a swing at John Jones, the man that shot him. Jones said he thought he saw Timmy drawing a gun out of his coat pocket, and Jones fired first. Mm-hmm. So Timmy died right there in the street. He was shot in the lung and the heart, so he died right there. They found Jones later. He took off running after that, but they found him and took him to jail. Where he sat for, he was the newspapers, when you read the accounts of them describing him.
Oh, yeah.
Just and newspapers at the time were so bad. It was a murder that happened right on Main Street, 4th and Main. Mm-hmm. But when you juxtapose that with the other one that happened a couple months later, Jones was he pled not guilty. He said it was self-defense. But then, I guess the Von Behren incident is exemplifies the lack of justice in the community between black and white. Von Behren was 20 in his 20s, and he was the son of B.F. Von Behren, who owned a planing mill. But young Von Behren gets up from his desk in the factory one Saturday morning, walks downstairs carrying two pistols, and he shoots to death three of the black workmen working in the planing mill in cold blood, and then just waits for the police to come get him. And so Von Behren was sitting in the same jail as John Jones, but he's the son of this wealthy man.
Sure.
So his mother is sending him a new suit every day with a clean white shirt. The newspapers talk about his friends coming to visit him. And so Jones is convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. So Von Behren, his father, negotiates with the prosecutor because they realize that Von Behren, young Von Behren, Allen, had some mental issues, had been in an asylum. His parents had told people that he'd been sent to military school, but he was actually in a mental hospital. He'd had wild, violent episodes of imagining things. He said that these three black workmen were plotting against him. Of course, none of them had weapons on them. Mm-hmm. There was no evidence of that. But the dad knew that if Von Behren if his son was found innocent by reason of insanity, there'd be racial problems in the city. So they negotiated with the prosecutor and the judge, who was a friend of the dad,
of course,
that Allen would plead guilty to manslaughter on one of the killings and be sentenced to the state farm, where he could be evaluated by by psychiatrists, but he would have a guilty plea, and therefore he would not be innocent. But he was sentenced to 2 to 20 years, but he only served a couple years. His dad managed to get him a pardon from the governor of the state at the time, and so he was released. He lived to be, 70 years old. He'd actually become a parachutist, a celebrity parachute jumper at circuses and fairs. But to me, that shows, he killed three men in cold blood and only served a couple years, where Jones was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
And thus the question, where was the indignation?
Right? Where was the indignation there?
My guest is Kelly Coors. He's the author of Indignation, A History of Politics and Race in Evansville. Now, coming up, the Fred Ostenberg-Benjamin Bossy feud. That's good. The rise and fall of the KKK, and then even a black boycott of local stores. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guest is Kelly Coors, author of Indignation, A History of Politics and Race in Evansville, 1870 to 1950. Let's go back in time. Now, there's a tug of war for black votes among the political parties, vote buying, charges of voter fraud, and cries for reform. The city is also dealing with corruption at City Hall, widespread gambling and bootleg booze during Prohibition. Rival newspapers are fanning the flames, and there's indignation. Who's going to clean up the mess? Well, is that someone, Benjamin Bossy?
Well, Benjamin Bossy is one of the most celebrated mayors in Evansville's history. He accomplished an awful lot of things. There, Bossy High School, Bossy Field. He was the first mayor to believe in city planning, laying out neighborhoods in horizontal and vertical streets that all connected to one another. But there was a side to Ben Bossy that is largely, I think, lost to history. But he was a smart politician, and he knew when to form alliances and when to cut those alliances off. But we talked about Fred Ostenberg as a political boss. Fred Ostenberg, after 1903, he became a real powerhouse in the old 7th Ward, which is now the 4th Ward. The 7th Ward was the largest population of black voters. And Ostenberg, you had machines in the machine politics. You had the men that were men, and after 1920, women that were part of these machines that would—
And patronage was
right,
big.
Patronage. You had money. A lot of the money, a lot of the white politicians that ruled the game, they would preach against the black population, blaming black people for the problems in the city, for vice, for gambling, for prostitution, for all these things. You had High Street, which was downtown, which was the red light district, basically. And you had Baptist Town, where streets didn't even connect a lot of the time. You had a lot of houses of prostitution there. But at election time, they would go out and recruit black voters to vote for them. And they're the ones that actually made the money from a lot of these vice operations here. There's a great book, Wide Open Evansville, by a descendant of Edgar Schmidt, who was the police chief that went to prison for running booze. But that scandal, and then there was the election fraud scandal, 1917, 1918, where, all these men were arrested for vote buying and manipulation. And gambling was a problem.
But Bossy survived all this.
He survived all of them, barely. he won his first election narrowly. His first primary, he won by 4 votes. But that first election in 1913, he made sort of the journal called it an unholy alliance with Fred Ostenberg, because he wanted those black votes that Ostenberg controlled. And he appointed Fred Ostenberg as president of the safety board, which operated the police department. And the journal news called it a ghastly joke that the man responsible for much of the vice and crime was in charge of the police department. It was just insane.
Mm-hmm. But where is the indignation?
But where's the indignation there? But Ostenberg survived that first the first few years with Bossy, but there was a break between them. And by the time Bossy's last election in 1921, Ossenberg and his cronies were absolutely against Benjamin Bossy, for they were for John Stuart Hopkins, who was a reform Republican, but all the vice operators were for him because they wanted to get rid of Ben Bossy. And his last election was very narrow. You know, you think of a third term, a popular mayor is going to win by a huge landslide, but it was only 700 votes out of thousands that were cast. Yeah. But Bossy died. You know, he was in very poor health. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it took its toll on him, and he died in April after the 21 election.
He actually owned the Courier.
He didn't like what they were saying about him, so he bought it. You know, he was only 46 years old when he passed away from pneumonia, which, you know, that kind of struck me that only 46, so young, right, to me anyway. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in that same week, Fred Ossenberg lost his brother, who'd been chief of detectives under Ben Bossy. You know, so you had this irony of these two men that had been powerful dying at the same time.
And Ossenberg eventually went to prison, didn't he?
Fred Ossenberg went to prison. He went to prison for that liquor scandal. I love that book, Wide Open Evansville. It's so good. But yeah, Fred Ossenberg, he went to prison, but he came back. He got a pardon from President Harding. Harding administration gave him a pardon, and he came back to town. But he only survived a couple years. He died of a stroke. Mm-hmm. He and Ben Bartlett, there's another political boss of the future.
I was going to talk about him, right?
They were all, Harry Rowbottom, who became Congress, they were all on a hunting trip, and Ossenberg had a stroke while they were out hunting quail. And he died before they could get him back home.
Bartlett was his protege, wasn't he?
Bartlett was his protege. Bartlett took over where Ossenberg left off.
And a lot of the information you get in your book, too, is from these tell-all accounts that Bartlett gave to the Evansville Press.
It was a series. 1950s. He told everything. He just sort of let go, you know, let his what little hair he had left. He let it down and told everything. But Ossenberg really had two proteges. He had a black protege and a white protege. Ben Bartlett was his white protege, but Ernest Tidrington was his black protege. And these two, Bartlett and Tidrington, in the 1920s into the 30s. Really ruled the game. And Bartlett, of course, extended up into the 40s with Manson mm-hmm. Reichert. But Tidrington was killed in 1930. But these two were his proteges and took over when Ossenberg died.
Mm-hmm. Now to one of the most controversial periods in Evansville history, the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. There was a huge gathering at Mesker Park in June of 1923, a large parade for only white, Protestant, Gentile, American-born men.
Right. Right. Well, there was a ladies' auxiliary,
of course,
that women could join. But there was a doctor, William French, who actually became coroner later. William French had written a letter to Bill Simmons, who was the grand dragon, I guess, of the Klan. But you know, it seemed to reform-minded observers that city government had become the enemy of the people. That there was so much corruption and so much graft. And, you know, High Street, the prostitution district. In 1917, Ben Bossy, in his address to city council, he made a crazy statement that, you know, if you made it today, but he said that vice should be controlled, that you had to have an area of vice that you could control to keep it from spreading to the other parts of your city. And so that High Street area was where he wanted to concentrate all that vice. Hmm. But French said that there were immoral forces that were moving the city into what he called the abyss. And he thought that maybe the Klan could come and clean it all up. And later French said that he was sucker number one, that he regretted ever sending that letter to Simmons that drew the Klan to Evansville. But mm-hmm. but interestingly, by 1924, something like 25% of the white male population in Evansville belonged to the Klan.
You call 1924 the year of the Klan.
It was the year of the Klan. That election year, they elected Ed Jackson governor. They elected a number of legislators. They didn't have a majority, but they had enough legislators to kill You know, because D.C. Stevenson, the famous Klan mm-hmm. leader in Indianapolis, he'd started here. But Joe Huffington was the local leader of the Klan.
The Cyclops.
The Cyclops, the Grand Cyclops. But Huffington and Stevenson split. Stevenson went to Indianapolis, controlled the state Klan. And, of course, by 1925, he was in prison for second-degree murder for the death of Madge Oberholzer. But the Klan in Evansville hung on. You know, even though the Klan collapsed statewide, Evansville, you know, the Vandenberg County, Clavern, as they called it, mm-hmm. separated itself from the statewide Klan. So Huffington maintained his power. The Klan had controlled the county commissioners. Shelby McDowell was head of the county commissioners, former sheriff. He was a Klansman. The county attorney was a Klan. Hardin was a Klansman. But there was conflicts between city and county. You know, Bossie died in 22, and Mayor Elmendorf, William Elmendorf, took control. And Elmendorf was a Lutheran. He was a very moral, he had a strident moral character, and he refused any allegiance to the Klan. He wanted to stop them. Every turn he made, he stopped them from doing things. So Huffington decided that in addition to county government, they were going to take city government. And they recruited Herbert Mayles, who had a long history of Republican politics. He'd been sheriff. You know, he'd been embroiled in that whiskey ring, mm-hmm. But had been ruled innocent. But Mayles was their candidate in 25 for mayor. And Ernest Tidrington, the black boss of Baptist Town, they nicknamed him, he corralled the black vote for Herbert Mayles because Mayles promised to build a new segregated high school on Lincoln Avenue for black students who mostly lived in that area. They didn't. Clark Street, the Clark Street High School was where Channel 44 studios are now, over on mm-hmm. 2nd Street. So black students had to walk a long way to get to their high school. So building that new school on Lincoln Avenue was the answer. And that Mayles won in a landslide, that 1925 election. 8-1 Republican City Council. It was just an avalanche, and the press called it the city's darkest hour because they knew what was coming. And sure enough, Mayles' 4 years in office was scandal ridden. He had accepted money from the Klan and lied about it. Mm-hmm. He almost had to resign. But he made it through the end of his term. He got beaten in his party's primary in 1929. But the Klan eventually lost its control here with that 1929 election and the scandals that Herbert Mayles had right. in his administration.
Now back to Ernest Tidrington. He mm-hmm. wanted the high school named after him, right?
He did. Mayles, I think, promised it to him. He said Mayles had promised him because that little short section of Garvin Street that runs in front of the African American Museum. Of course, Lincoln Gardens wasn't there yet right. in 1925. That didn't come along for another 12 years. But he renamed that little short street Tidrington Avenue, and he promised Tidrington that it would lead to the front doors of his high school. But the school board named it Lincoln School. Mm-hmm. And Tidrington was furious about that, and he blamed some of the black leaders in the community for that. And one of them was a man named Luther Bell, who owned a pool room.
There we go. Luther Bell is arrested for assassinating Tidrington.
He was. It was cold. It was January 1930. Frank Greasy had taken over as mayor. And as promised, Tidrington jumped ship. He jumped from the Republicans to the Democrats to support Frank Greasy in 1929 when Mayles lost his primary. So Tidrington got a promise out of Greasy that he would close some of these businesses on Lincoln Avenue that didn't support him.
Sure.
And Luther Bell's pool room was one of them that got closed. And I guess Luther Bell was so overcome by the torture that he'd experienced under Tidrington that one night he saw Tidrington pull up in front of a drugstore across the street on Lincoln. And he grabbed his shotgun and walked out and blew Tidrington's brains out in the car. But Bell was put on trial. He was ruled innocent by reason of insanity and put in the state hospital over the weekend. And the judge, Bach, had him evaluated. And the psychiatrist said, well, he's cured.
and they let him out. And so his pool room reopened. Later it became a tavern after Prohibition ended. But he died. He lived to be 65. He died in a car crash almost to the day that he killed Tidrington.
Okay, racial tensions flare up in 1937. That's the year of the flood.
Right.
A grocer is killed. And then James Swain eventually executed for that
murder? He was one of the youngest people ever executed in the United States. You have to remember people lived in poverty.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of the black population, with the exception of maybe school teachers, ministers, barbers, people who owned businesses, lived in, and these two boys lived in Villa Sites, which was a horrible area of the city. And they were going to rob this grocer that had the grocery store on Lincoln. And when they came in with this shotgun, I guess Swain panicked when he took off after him with a knife that he'd been cutting meat with and killed him. And Swain was put on trial. His partner in this was given life, but he was sentenced to death because he's the one that pulled the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the black community rallied around him. There was a black newspaper at the time from 38 to 43 called the Argus.
Right.
And the Argus argued that, Julius Holder argued that, you know, if they'd taken into account his life of poverty, having no parents at home, having no supervision, having no guidance, that he might have been his sentence reduced to life. But, you know, it was all of his attempts at commutation were denied, and he was executed.
Well, still to come, we're going to talk about a black boycott of stores to get blacks hired, the importance of the NAACP, and the push for more recreational and educational opportunities. I'm David James. My guest is Kelly Coors, author of Indignation, A History of Politics and Race in Evansville, 1870 to 1950. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you are just joining us, my guest is Kelly Coors, author of Indignation, A History of Politics and Race in Evansville from 1870 to 1950. Kelly, of course, you worked in local government, executive director of the Evansville Department of Metropolitan Development. You have received recognition as a change maker in the community. You are an advocate for civil rights, especially in the LGBTQ community. Did Indignation guide this path for social justice in your case?
Well, I worked on this book it took me 3 years to finish this book, and there are so many parallels between the story of Evansville politics, the black community, and the search for a voice. Out in Evansville was trying to find a voice for LGBTQ plus people. From Stonewall to marriage rights was less than 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look back at Evansville's politics and history of politics and race, you go back 100 years for people to find a voice. So I think in that way, it affects you differently when you look at it.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's go back to the book. There's a growing black middle class, demands for change. The black newspaper, we talked about, the Argus, the NAACP pushes for more educational and recreational opportunities.
You know, the opening of the Mechanic Arts High School. The school board, dealing with the Depression, decided to build a separate school for the trades for boys that they would learn tool and die, carpentry, auto mechanics, things that they could earn money for, you know, trying to deal with the Depression and finding a trade. But remember, schools were separate. So the new mechanic arts school was segregated. Black students couldn't attend classes there. And then later that actually became more important during the war because the mechanic arts school offered night courses for adults who were trying to get jobs in the new war plants. And there were protest after protest after protest trying to get the school board to open up mechanic arts to black students. And finally they relented and started a tool and die shop at Lincoln. But it was very late when that happened. They simply would not allow black students to go there. But at the same time, there were a number of markets, stores along Lincoln Avenue, which was, you know, was really sort of our Black Wall Street. You know, Lincoln Avenue was the setting for barbershops and taverns and stores. You know, you had the Canal Department Store off to one angle over there. But a lot of them were owned by whites. And the white store owners refused to hire black people in their stores, even though they were in the black community. So there was a group of students at Lincoln School, which had been open about 10 years by that time. But they called themselves the Merrymakers. And they started walking with signs out in front of one of the grocery stores, Richards Market, Clarence Richards. And the signs they carried said, "Don't buy here if you can't work here." Mm-hmm. And that they went to the local NAACP and asked, you know, "Hey, can you help us?" And within about a week or so, there were marchers in front of every white-owned store and gas station in the neighborhood. And business fell off to nothing. And these places were throwing away food that was spoiled because it was unbought. And finally, the Argus, the black newspaper, reported that stores were starting to hire some black employees. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a big headline. But it just shows you the power of economics.
Sure.
That was, you know, picked up later. But it was that 1939 period. It was, I think it all started with the protest about mechanic arts, because the black community leaders were saying, you know, we pay $1 million in property taxes. Our tax money went to build that school, but you won't let our children go there.
Right, right.
Just incredible.
Right. And of course, this during the FDR administration, Lincoln Gardens Project was launched to clear out that slum area. Right. That was a major improvement for the black community.
Major improvement.
Now, the term of Mayor Bill Dress, he was a Democrat. The Evansville Courier described his victory as a new day for the city. And Dress had it kind of interesting. He kind of staggered terms.
Well, he was elected, you know, the state moved elections ahead a year. A skip election bill was put during the Depression to save money, because elections are expensive. And so you had an election in 29, there would have been one in 33, but they had one in 34 instead. And so in 1934, Greasy had become very unpopular in his own party because of a scandal with the police department. The party blamed him for publicizing this police scandal, the hearings and all that happened in the early 30s. And so Ed Diekman, who'd been terminated from his position, he resigned his position on the safety board, but Ed Diekman got his friend Bill Dress to run for mayor in that primary. And of course, Carl K. Connect, the most famous cartoon I think he ever did, was the one where the woman is saying, you know, "Hey, take out this greasy spot and give me the dress." Greasy blamed that cartoon for his defeat, but it was his own problems that defeated him. But Bill Dress was elected in 34, and then he was elected again in 38 in a landslide. And mainly the 38 victory was he showed great intelligence and courage during the flood of 37, got a lot of assistance for people after the flood. And then by the late 30s, bringing in war work, bringing in, you know, industries to because we, I guess America knew it was going to go to war.
Right.
And so to prep for that war. But interestingly, all of that accolade, that big landslide in 1938, he ended up losing the election in 1942 to Manson Reichert, who'd been a sand and gravel contractor, later concrete contractor. Manson Reichert beat him. Ben Bartlett was his campaign manager and financier. Of course, Bartlett took credit for Reichert's victory. But he did. He beat him for a third term in 1942. But then Bill Dress, Reichert was a character. You know, I mean, that's the only way to put it. He was a real character. And he became unpopular. And then Bill Dress came back in 1947 after the next skip election bill moved it, city elections back to the off year, and he was elected to his third term. But you know, he died in 1949. He only served a couple years of that third term, and he passed away. But his friend Ed Diekman, that had engineered his victory in 34, he'd promoted Ed Diekman to city controller, which in those days
when a mayor died, the controller would take over by state law and serve the rest of the term. Now I think they have a caucus, but the controller would take over. And so he made sure that Diekman was his controller. He knew he had cancer. He knew he had cancer when he ran in 47, but it really got bad in 48, 49, he died. But he made sure Diekman got to be mayor.
Now, there's a great chapter in the book titled Guns Drawn. And this is one of those things, you can't make this up
you
either.
You can't make it up.
I mean, this is a wild story.
You can't make it up. Well, Manson Reichert was mayor from 42 to 47. And there was an incident with a Central High School basketball coach, Glenn Bretz. The school board, he was very popular. The school board fired him from his job as basketball coach at Central. They had just won the state championship.
And he's fired.
And he got fired. And, of course, the mayor appointed the school board then. And so Reichert called all of his lieutenants in to figure out what they were, because they were, all the students had walked out from the three public high school. They were marching through downtown. The students were protesting. They were all outside City Hall at 3rd and Walnut, closed the streets. There were so many people protesting. The parents were angry. And Mayor Reichert called all of his lieutenants together, but Bartlett refused to be part of it. And Reichert said, well, he's yellow. And it got printed in the newspaper that he called his friend yellow. And Bartlett, that was the split. Bartlett turned on his friend. And then so Reichert lost that election in 47. Bartlett supported Dress publicly. He was still a Republican, but he supported Dress in the election. And so in the next primary in 48, there was a polling place on Belmead Avenue, 512 Belmead Avenue. Ben Bartlett and Clarence Coogan, who had been a sheriff's deputy at one time, were sitting in Bartlett's automobile outside the polling place. Well, they saw Manson Reichert drive up in his automobile. He got out and went up, started walking up to the polling place. Well, Bartlett and Coogan got out. Manson Reichert started screaming at Ben Bartlett that he was going to kill him, and he drew his gun. Manson Reichert had a gun with him, and he drew his pistol. And the congressman, Ed Mitchell, was with Ben Bartlett. And Mitchell grabbed, Coogan had drawn his gun. Congressman Mitchell grabbed Coogan around the waist, and Coogan dropped his gun. Congressman Mitchell picked it up. At that moment, Ben Bartlett socked Manson Reichert in the jaw, knocked him into Belmead Avenue. He dropped his gun, and the whole melee ended. Finally, Manson Reichert's son-in-law got him in the car and begged everybody to back off so he could get Reichert out of there.
So no shots were fired.
No shots were fired, okay. Thank God. But it really demonstrated that bitterness between Bartlett and Reichert. And the Republican Party at the time was in such chaos. And Bill Dress, he said, you know, the people can see we offer sane government. we offer sane government.
And Congressman Ed Mitchell...
He was censured by the House.
For just being there.
Being involved in that. And, of course, he lost that election in 48. Winfield Denton beat him for the congressional seat.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, now, before we close, let's talk about reaction to your first book, Out in Evansville. What's been the reaction to that? I know a lot of copies have been sold.
The fellows that operate Your Brother's Books on your program credited with being their number one seller in 2023. Which I really appreciated. I wrote that book for a variety of reasons, but I hope people don't think you make a lot of money writing a book. you get about $2.98 for every copy that's sold, and so you don't make a ton of money. But I wrote that book for a reason, and it's basically the same reason I wrote this book. People don't know what happened here. You know, the stories that were in Out in Evansville were buried for so long. Another book came along 2 years ago about the Rudy Ziemer killing,
right?
The Silk Finisher, which was very good.
Yes.
And I was glad to see that. You know, people were calling me saying, "Hey, aren't you upset this guy's done?" I was like, "No, it's great. It helps my book." Mm-hmm. But this particular the stories that are in this particular book in Indignation, I think have been buried for so long. That, you know, I carefully chose the photographs for the cover
the picture of the seven mayors in 1945, I thought was really important because you get to see all of the men that we talked about, that are talked about in the book. And then the picture of the segregated YMCA, which stood there on the corner where Kennedy Tower stands now, that's a real testament to where Evansville was in the early part of the 20th century, so segregated, so separate. And then a picture of young Alan von Baron with his collie that the Lawrenceburg Museum of History found for me. They allowed me to use that picture of a young man who ended up murdering three people and ended up with a pardon. I thought those three photographs were appropriate for the cover of the book.
And Kelly, just think, now we have a black woman as mayor of Evansville.
Incredible. I think she's doing a great job. I really compliment Stephanie Terry as often as I can, you know, on social media, because she's, you know, she's doing all the right things. She's going to all the right places, you know, being accessible, which is what you want your mayor to be. You know, I think all of our mayors in the modern era have been accessible and have done, you know, Jonathan Weinsapel was a good mayor. You know, I worked for Randy Shepard when he ran for mayor in 79 against Mike Vandeveer. And, you know, I was heartsick when Vandeveer won. But, you know, Mike Vandeveer turned out to be a great mayor. He made great strides for the city and in infrastructure, you know, raising the riverfront so you could see the river instead of having the flood wall there. And so I think all of our modern mayors, you know, we don't have those bosses anymore that buy and sell, you know, votes. We have open and fair elections. But I think it's a miracle that Stephanie Terry's our mayor now, and a wonderful miracle.
Kelly Coors, thanks for the history lesson. I really enjoyed the book, Indignation.
Well, thank you for having me. And if I can get my neurons to fire properly, I want to write a book about women in Evansville's history of politics, which is an interesting story if I can piece it all together.
Well, looking forward to that. Thanks a lot, Kelly.
Thanks.